one of the peak experiences, peak religious experiences of my childhood. Came at a time that I was probably at what I would call my peak religiosity as a child. I was a devout Jewish kid, and this probably happened when I was 12 or so. It was a celebration of Simchat Torah, which means rejoicing in the Torah, rejoicing in the law, the instruction that God has given, that's in the five books of Moses. And it's in the fall, at the end of the holiday of Sukkot, and one literally rejoices in the physical Torah. So at our synagogue, we took out all of the Torah scrolls, there were about seven in our congregation, and danced around with them, singing joyful songs, and we had a sanctuary that opened up the doors between the divider between the sanctuary and the social hall so that we could more freely dance right out into the social hall, as well as up and down the aisles of the sanctuary. And as we got hot from all the dancing and laughing, people opened up the doors right to the parking lot, and we danced in lines with the carriers of the Torah leading the way out into the parking lot. It was the first year that I was old enough to carry the Torah myself. And I vividly remember the feeling, the weight of it on my shoulder, the feeling of responsibility, the dangling silver items that bounced as I danced, and the velvet of the cover as people leaned over to kiss the Torah as I went by. It was so joyous, a feeling of abandon and happiness, a feeling of connection, not only to the people rejoicing that night, but to everybody who had rejoiced in the Torah over 5,000 years of this tradition. When I thought back to this, this experience, identifying it as a peak moment, it's been with a pang and a shrug. A pang because it would be nice to be able to have such an experience again, that complete loss of myself in being the newest link in a chain going back 5,000 years and feeling so connected to the source of my being, this God who had created me and everybody there and everything and given us this instruction right there in how to live well. Carrying the Torah, which I loved like a baby in my dancing arms. It was lovely. So a pang, but also a shrug, because the fact that I can't restore my faith in that God who gave us that Torah is not a sad thing. I wouldn't want to. I left him behind for good reasons, and I'm happy with where I've come since. But recently, so recently, I discovered an essay I can't believe I'd never heard of before by a philosopher who I had heard of, and I'm going to be, there's a nice interpretation of him by a woman named Margaret Placentra Johnston. So you can be glad that I'm reading you her words, because Paul Ricoeur is one of the more unreadable philosophers I've ever tempted, and I've read a lot. But he wrote a lecture that became a book back in the 60s entitled The Religious Significance of Atheism. And he was very interested in the development of religion as a whole. And it does apply to that, but also to, I think, to our individual lives. Now, in his view, and it's a little derogatory toward traditional religion, he saw the two main functions of traditional religion as being what he called accusation and consolation, which means, on the one hand, taboos and dogmas, you know, things that we must do or must not do. And then consolation is shelter and protection. Your religion tells you what not to do, and it also offers you some comfort. That's how he saw primitive religion, his word. And he said that he considered that archaic, but that atheism was essential in questioning these and setting that kind of religion off to one side and clearing the ground for a faith beyond that. This he called a second naivete. He says, you know, we have to go through this critical distance phase where we say, you know, these stories of what is taboo are maybe superstition, these stories of shelter and comfort, maybe also childish hopes. But beyond the desert, the rational stage of criticism, he said, there is this second naivete. And in this second naivete, scripture and religious concepts and all those things that we may have left behind are seen as symbols, metaphorical constructs that we now interpret in the full responsibility of autonomous thought. We don't accept them as at face value as presented by religious authorities, but rather interpret them for ourselves in the light of having assumed personal responsibility for our beliefs. When I think about my childhood experience and the loss and possibility there in terms of second naivete, I wonder, might it be that I don't have to lose the ecstasy, the joy, the sense of connection along with the God that I ceased to believe in? It's as if there had been a smaller aspect to that experience and a larger one. I believed in that God who had made everything and that Torah that were instructions from that God to us. And that was a rather small belief. It didn't seem small at the time. But in terms of possibility, rather small, like Rilke's stone, a little stone that I could lose. And the larger part of the experience was the joy and wonder and abandon and connection with these people and the past and seekers everywhere. And yes, the small led to the large. Believing in that God and that Torah was what at that time gave me that joy and sense of abandon. But it's not the only thing that does. The fact that the content has changed does not mean I have to lose everything about that feeling of being a child of deep feeling and religion. You know, when we are children, we have usually fairly simplistic ways of thinking. Children, if they are lucky enough to be with trustworthy adults who love them, they believe what they're told, and the world they're told about is quite simple. And they enjoy simple stories. Then they become teenagers, and teenagers seldom do enjoy simple stories. They don't want to be told simple stories about what happened and what they should be. They see through all that. And so there's this phase of rebellion, of breaking free of the simple innocence of childhood. And that paves the way for a period of rationality that, as Ricoeur talks about, we start to ask ourselves, what's really possible? Okay, I was told this, but what can be true? Where are the contradictions between elements of the story that I've been told? And the discovery of these contradictions, now that we have the willingness to be rebellious and the means to be rational, often drives us straight out of the faith of our childhood, if we had one. It's just become too small to hold them, to hold us. And these contradictions can be things like people claiming a principle, such as love of neighbor, but showing intolerance in their lives. Many, many people leave the faith in which they grew up, or the family in which they grew up, because of the hypocrisy. You see, there's a contradiction between word and deed here. A contradiction such as I experienced of realizing God was being portrayed both as omnipotent and all good, and that seemed to be contradicted by the evil and suffering that we are now aware flourishes in the world. Again, we may be sheltered from that as children, but as we discover it, then we have to solve that problem. And that contradiction may drive us out. And then there's the contradiction of the scripture of the religion making claims, say, about the age of the earth or the origin of species that don't square with the science that we come to know and believe. And out of all of these contradictions comes another. The contradiction of being religious, describing ourselves in those terms or affiliating with a religion, when so much about religion is problematic. All of this is a very important process of maturing. It's a needed corrective to a childish approach to religion. Ricoeur talks about how we have to do that as a people, as civilizations, and each of us has to do it in our own way, regardless of how we grew up, if we are to grow up into mature and thoughtful and possibly faith-filled adults. I mean, even Paul, the founder of so much that is troubling in Christianity, said, "When I was a child, I talked like a child, and I thought like a child and reasoned like a child, but when I grew into an adult, I put away these childish things." You have to grow up. Spiritual development is development. It changes. So along comes Ricoeur to talk about what these stages may be. And in this, he's not so different from James Fowler, who was a pioneer of thinking in terms of spiritual development, just as people think in physical and emotional and psychological development. Fowler laid out 6 stages of faith, and his 5th stage, I want to talk about the 6th today, the 5th is an ability to hold contradictions, an embrace of paradox. I did not know what that could possibly mean until I was pondering this experience of mine in the light of Ricoeur. So, for example, this contradiction of the scripture saying the earth is less than 10,000 years old and it's, species were created all in 6 days by fiat, by God. The person in this 5th stage resolves this, not by saying both are right, they contradict each other, but that they're, if we conceive of them differently, there's a value there that does not have to be discarded. If you discard the idea that the Bible is telling you facts and history, then you now have myths that you can hold side by side with what you know from science. Like today is Epiphany in the Christian tradition. Now, did 3 men, magicians, kings, wise people, dare to pay homage to the baby Jesus? Well, a childish faith says, sure. And a rebellious stage says, give me a break. And then an adult faith says, no, I don't believe things like that. That doesn't square with what I know about the world. And in Fowler's 5th stage, the mature seeker after truth and enlightenment may say, I can hold the myth and the facts side by side, not trying to resolve their contradictions, but just appreciating each for what it is, which I think is what we do here in this church, where we celebrate, we don't tend to celebrate Epiphany on a regular basis, but Christmas we do. I would mistrust a Unitarian Universalism that tossed out all the old myths. I would miss the Christmas carols for one thing, but also I would be worried that it was stuck at this earlier, less mature stage, a stage of rebellion, or maybe that next stage of rationality. And we have other models for how to hold these contradictions. William Blake gave us one in his Songs of Innocence and Experience. I realized that I had about 3 or 4 sermons here. One of them could analyze some of these poems side by side. So I decided just one sermon this morning. So maybe I'll go into detail another time, which would also be a great time to talk about the necessary tension between emotional abandon and rationality and religion. That's so rich, but you know, another time. So Blake wrote these Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience, and many of the poems are very similar. One to the other in these paired books, and they're all very interesting, complex poems on either side of the ledger. But Experience, it's clear as you read them side by side, corrects the naive, simplistic bliss of childhood. Cynicism. So it seems to me that what Blake is showing us in putting these side by side is that experience should not replace innocence. Some of that spirit of innocence is still needed, that freshness and wonder. And then experience is needed as well maybe innocence can keep us from falling into cynicism, and experience can keep us from walking with our head in the clouds. We're looking for a synthesis. I was thinking, when I thought about reading the Rilke, I thought, oh boy, can I read this story about a childlike faith in God in this church? How will that go? Some people here I know believe in God and some don't. Some did as children and some never did. And I thought, and you could, replace the word there, God, with something else, like mystery. That would work. But that's what Mr. Kappas was worried about, his childhood God. And Elaine Pagels, too. Now, the story here that she tells in her memoir is very personal and scholarly as well. She's a great scholar of our time. The author you may know from the Gnostic Gospels, so one of the foremost scholars of the discovered Gospels that were in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and what those might mean for religion and the development of Christianity, and fabulous ideas that were hidden for millennia. And then she's also written about Adam and Eve and the origin of the idea of Satan. Here she talks about moving from a very rationalist, suspicious idea of religion. That's how she grew up, right here in Palo Alto. And when she was 15, she went with friends to a revival by Billy Graham. And to her parents' great dismay and disgust, was completely taken with evangelical Christianity. The way that the preacher situated all of us in the part of a great story that explains all of creation and what will happen at the end of time, that gave her meaning and reassured her that she was welcome, in the words of the hymn, just as she was. And she was involved in that church, the Peninsula Bible Church right here, for some time, until when she was still young, in her 20s, a dear friend, also young, died very suddenly in a car accident. And when she went with her grief to her evangelical friends, one of the things they wanted to know, perhaps looking for a way to comfort her, was he born again? You know, if he was, they could have said, don't worry, he's with God. He's in a better place than we are right now. She said, no, he was Jewish. And they said, oh, then he's in hell. And she walked out and never went back, not finding at all the comfort that she was looking for. But the following decades that she tells slowly brought her back through scholarly roots and through the grueling experiences of losing her son and husband to another, more mature religion, by which I don't mean evangelical. Religion is immature, but that her understanding had been very simplistic. And she came back around to more complex ways, in particular, religion deals with suffering. Things that she could trust and respect in these scriptures that she did not accept necessarily as gospel, but that guided her and continue to guide her in difficult times. As, thanks to her, some of these texts have for other people who found Christianity, as it was told to them, much too simplistic. Unitarian Universalism was born of a rebellion against certain ideas in the Christianity of an earlier time. Our ancestors, questioned the Trinity and the divinity of Jesus, the existence of hell and the idea that anyone was created only to go there. We noted the contradiction between a loving parent God and eternal punishment, and between the minds that we were given and the observations that we could make with them, and the stories of the world being created in 6 days and the sun being made to stand still by fiat and so on. I think that those early Unitarians and Universalists grew a maturer faith. Now, in recent decades, there's been a shift in Unitarian Universalism towards a language of reverence, towards more prayer and ritual in our services, towards belief in God of different kinds. And this shift has been welcomed by some, decried by others. And until I was thinking about my childhood experiences in the light of Paul Ricoeur, I would have said, and probably did say to some of you, that I thought it was a pendulum shift, that, you know, religion shifts, and we had been on a very rationalist swing of the pendulum, and now we were trying to correct that a little bit by going into the irrational, if not irrational, aspects of religion, and it would swing back. And that may be what's happening, but you know, I no longer hope so. I hope that instead what we are seeing is an integration. Because that's what happens if we are to grow into maturity personally. We need all those things. We need the rebelliousness of the teen years when we realize, you know, we don't have to believe something just because somebody else does or somebody tells us so. We need to hold on to that. And we need to hold on to the childhood innocence and openness. And we need to hold on to our critical distance of adulthood. All of those things are important, and we have to integrate them if we are to go on, not just swing between them. The root of the word naivete, and Paul Ricoeur was a native French speaker, so he knew exactly what he was talking about, is not about the pejorative sense that we have. It means what is inborn, what is natural. What do our nature and the nature of things as they are compel us to do, to practice, possibly to believe? Is there something of the child's view of the universe that we, in adulthood, can wisely regain? I think so. First, we have to know what it is. Can we even remember what it was like to approach this world as a child, before rebellion, before rationality? And if we do glimpse it, then we're going to glimpse things that we have dropped for good reason, and we'll have to be willing to hold the paradox. I think the road to it, well, I can think of two roads to it, both of which Unitarian Universalists, and especially in this congregation, know well. One is science. Seeing what is, whatever is, without fear or prejudice. If it causes you to completely revise your view of the universe, so be it. It is that kind of search for truth. So what it means is a comfort with the unknown. The scientific life, ideally, is ideally situated to guide us to this second naivete. Why? Because true scientists never pretend to know what they don't know. They never shy away from the areas of the map where be dragons. Mystery is enticing to a scientific mind. They're drawn to the unknown. Now, scientists are drawn to the unknown in search of knowledge, absolutely, in search of dispelling the mysteries. But that knowledge is never complete. It reveals new questions, new mysteries. We hope so, and certainly in the course of any lifetime. And another guide that I think we know well in this congregation, and that Unitarians and Universalists knew way back when they were first breaking away from the Calvinist tradition in the early years of this country, is Buddhism. Learning to behold what is, whatever is, including our own not knowing, including mystery. Now, it's development that the entire progress has been trying to be more and more able to tolerate not knowing. So I'm going to do some wild projection here. and assert that the entire progress of our religion, if it is to be progress and not a 100 mile per hour run into a dead end, is the greater and greater ability to tolerate not knowing, to rest in mystery. Children live there blissfully, which is not so hard if you're having a happy, healthy childhood. You don't need to know what's going to happen next. The world is unknown and you still feel safe. And then adolescents encounter that not knowing and react with challenge and with anger sometimes and with resting on what they can know and do know. The adults who live with them and find this irritating may say they need to know everything, but I think teenagers probably think the same thing about the grown-ups. That's how I felt. And then we move into this more measured maturity. But don't we as adults tend to dwell too much in what we know? We become expert in something, and that's where we stay. We surround ourselves with a circle of friends and music and writers whom we like, and we tend to stay there where it's tested and practical. And Ricoeur invites us to a further stage, to once again wonder and awe and amazement, curiosity. It's always ourselves we find in the sea, E. Cummings said in that wonderful poem Miles found for us. It's always ourselves we find, whether what we find there is small or large, closed off, or teeming with possibility. That depends on us. So, may what we find be a delight, a fearless embrace of mystery, and an integration of all that we have been and still can be.